Canada's Yukon Territory borders Alaska to the east, and anyone who's spent any time in the Yukon, or even just driven through, knows that it's a land of big lakes, long rivers, remote mountain ranges, and vast wilderness. It seems like a great place to go for a good long hike, but it's hard to know where to go since there aren't very many marked trails or developed trailheads in the Yukon. Earlier this winter, during a ski trip to Whitehorse, I met Megan and Marco Marjanovic, who recently published a coffee table book about hiking in the Yukon. So I stopped in one snowy afternoon for a little après ski to share a beer with them at their winter-long brewery and get some ideas for my next summer adventure in the Yukon. I hope you'll stick around with me, your host, Adam Verrier, here on Outdoor Explorer and listen in on my discussion about hiking in the Yukon Territory. Megan and Marco, thank you so much for joining me here at your brewery, the Winterlong Brewery, here on the eastern slope of Mount Sima, where I've been skiing all week with the University of Alaska ski team, and we're having a beer here at your brewery. Thank you for joining me.
Absolutely,
great.
Thanks for coming.
It's good to be here.
So last year our skiers came here to Mount Sima for a ski race, and they all came home with a book. Called Yukon Hiking. I saw it floating around, and I managed to get my hands on the book. And I was looking through it, and when we were coming back this year for our training camp at Mount Sima, I thought I wanted to track you guys down and talk to you a little bit about hiking in the Yukon Territory, because I've been through the Yukon quite a lot, and I haven't done that much hiking here. But you have a whole book about it.
We do. It took a long time to accumulate all the hikes for the book, but we do have one now.
Have you lived in Yukon Territory your entire lives? Did you move here from somewhere else?
I was born here. So I lived here until I was 3 years old. My father was a miner up here. My mom worked at the government. And when I was three, we moved down to British Columbia, where my grandparents lived. And that's where I met Megan, my wife here. She was born in Dawson Creek.
Yeah, mile zero of the Alaska Highway.
Okay.
Yep.
That's right.
Claim to fame.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dawson Creek and then Fairbanks.
Yeah. We've lived here for 15 years now.
So Fairbanks? Yeah. You were...
Here.
Oh, okay.
We lived here. And so the mile zero of Alaska Highway goes from Dawson Creek to Fairbanks.
Yes. I've got the impression you lived in Fairbanks.
I haven't actually been there yet.
No.
Well, that'll be a trip for the future.
Yeah, we moved back. So when we finished university in 2008... we did a kind of a down under trip in Australia, New Zealand, and got the bug for hiking there. And when we were looking for a place to move to, we had just finished university, and we decided the Yukon because of the landscape and mountains and everything.
And we had been here on a road trip, I think 3 years prior to that, and did like 10 days and just hiked every day. Went to Skagway, went to Tombstone, Kluane, everything. So 3 years later, we're like, let's go back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's a pretty common story for people who live in Whitehorse now. Mm-hmm. I think that people that I've met in Whitehorse tend to live in Whitehorse maybe because of a job opportunity, but also largely because they really want to live in the Yukon Territory. Mm-hmm. And that seems like that's your case also, even though you had been born here.
I've been born here, but I mean, absolutely. Like when we were in Dawson Creek, where we were, you know, where Megan, we were raised, it's farmland. There aren't any mountains, you know, really that close. So to be able to be living in a central city that has mountains within, you know, striking distance was very appealing. And, you know, we had a few criteria. We wanted to be able to hike when we were looking for a place to live. We wanted to be able to hike. We needed a brewery and, you know, a shopping center. And there was a brewery in Whitehorse, Yukon Brewing. We had a Canadian Tire here and lots of mountains. So we decided to move back.
Okay.
Yeah.
We did not have jobs.
You did not have jobs.
No.
But we found some.
Running your own brewery. Or was that later?
This was later. We worked, I think, for eight or so years till we opened.
I was a software engineer.
Yeah. Okay.
hence the Yukon hiking website. It was kind of my playground when we moved to the Yukon before I got a job. I just experimented with creating a hiking website.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, and we'll have a link to the website on the show's webpage on Alaska Public Media. Initially, I'd like to just ask, what makes hiking in the Yukon Territory so special? What's so unique or special about hiking here as opposed to other places?
I think the most unique part of it, or the special part, and it's a double-edged sword, is the lack of people.
Yeah, the small population.
Very small population. There's 45,000 people that live in the Yukon, and then we get tourists in the summer. But that's not a lot of people for the size of the territory we have. So in terms of uniqueness, if you wanted to go for a hike, depending on the time of year and the hike you do, there's a good chance you will not see anybody. Mm-hmm. And that's a unique thing that we find. You know, we got tourists from Germany coming over and other parts of the country, and they, you know, for that sort of solitude. But it's a double-edged sword, because what's unique about the Yukon, even the most popular hikes, is there's no infrastructure. There's almost lack of trails. You know,
there's no trailhead signs or like turn left here.
Oh, really?
No signage. You wouldn't even know you're at the hike unless you followed some directions. So it's a double-edged sword. You've got that scenery all to yourself, but you've got to be prepared for going out and route finding for almost every single hike in the Yukon.
You just mentioned that there aren't really marked trailheads.
It's only in like the national park and territorial parks, really.
Yeah, and territorial parks and national parks comprise about what percentage of the land around here? Not much or very little?
Very little, yeah.
So are you typically hiking on First Nations land, on territorial land, on private land? What's the typical scenario? I'm sure it changes from place to place.
Well, it's mainly Crown land, but then, yeah, each First Nation, we have 14 First Nations in the Yukon. So, yeah, there are territories all over.
And do those jurisdictions tend to have some criteria? Is there anything you need to do to go? Or typically, if you're in the Yukon Territory and you see a nice place to hike, you just go.
Pretty much. Okay. That's what we did since we moved.
Right. That's right. You want to be sensitive to
private property
and
settlement land and stuff.
First Nation settlement land, and there's obviously times of year where you don't want to go where the animals are lambing. For example, the sheep are lambing. You want to avoid those. But in general, you could look at any mountain and go and try and climb it. Again, because it's the Yukon, there aren't any, a lot of forestry roads or access roads. So
there's a bit of like mining roads. So a lot of the hikes we have are like, go into this mining road, follow this old ATV, like cat track into the Alpine. And then from there, choose your adventure.
Okay. So. I think that in Alaska, especially in South Central Alaska, there's a lot of vegetation down low, which makes for pretty tough bushwhacking through willows and alders, and Devil's Club and cow parsnip and that sort of thing. But I think maybe you have less of that in a lot of the Yukon.
We don't have any Devil's Club.
Yes. No, oh, really? Devil's Club.
Oh, so if you don't like Devil's Club, just cross the border.
Come to Yukon.
And that must make for different hiking in that I've paddled the Yukon River up to Dawson City, and the landscape beside the river was typically, I think there was a lot of lodgepole pine and not much undergrowth.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that has anything to do with it being a lot of old growth forest, perhaps, and it's mature forest without much undergrowth.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of times, and driving too, I've looked off the side of the road and I've thought, I could walk across the landscape here pretty easily.
There are places for sure like that. And if you look at all sort of the different mountainous regions that are accessible in the Yukon, one of them is, say, Tombstone, which is just south of Dawson City, up north of the Dempster Highway. And yes, that's right. And you get into the tundra even. So little to no trees in some places in the Yukon. And then when you get to we don't have the big growth trees that Alaska and underbrush that Alaska has. It is getting a little bit wetter. Our climate is, it used to be semi-arid here, especially in Whitehorse. And with the wetness, with the, change in the climate comes more undergrowth. And it's getting maybe a little bit harder to hike than it used to be.
So you're seeing that, absolutely. Even in your own experience.
Yeah, absolutely. Some of the trails that we were doing 15 years ago have now almost grown over with bushes, that are maybe 6-7 feet high that weren't there, 15 years ago. So we definitely see the changing of the climate, even just in that short period of time. You know, just coming back to it, there's a couple hikes I've did the last couple of years where I've had friends 5 years ago raving about these overnight multi-day hikes. And there, I went to do one a couple years ago called Quill Creek in Kewaunee. And my hiking partner and I, we got a few hours into the trail, and then it says just go up onto this little plateau and hike for a couple more hours. You'll be at a nice campsite. Well, this plateau underneath it was all permafrost, and in the last 2 years, right before we hiked it, that permafrost melted. Instead of a flat plateau, it was a giant valley that was had like what they call it Kewaunee concrete. It's just like really steep rock that, and a fall is just, you don't want to fall. So it changed from a flat plateau into V-shaped gullies in about a year. And these are probably, how deep are they? Like some of them are 100, 150 feet deep.
Wow.
And you go on Google Earth and you look at them, and we matched them to our photos. Google Earth is just a nice flat plateau. And now these are 100 feet gullies that go up probably 300 feet up the mountainside. And so it changed the landscape completely. And in turn, and you know, what should have been a 3 hour beautiful hike for us turned into a 7 hour ordeal where we weren't sure if we were going to make it out alive, to be honest with you. It was quite an ordeal. Yeah. So the changing of the seasons is having an effect in the Yukon for sure, or the changing of the climate. Yeah. So.
And you have some glaciers in the Yukon territory also.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, though, you are likely seeing a recession of the glaciers, not only melting of the permafrost in more, I guess, low-lying areas, but the glaciers receding also. And mm-hmm. and have you, in all the time that you've spent out hiking, are you actually seeing changes in animal behavior, or is that something that maybe not as quite obvious as the moonscape of this area by the Kewaunee?
Right. I don't know if you've seen a lot of...
I don't think so.
One thing I'll say is, you know, I did an interview with Chris Gilbert's up the road up at Mount Sema.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking about eating insects for an earlier Outdoor Explorer show. And yesterday I was talking with him, and he said that he carries bear spray year round on him at all times, because he says he's always chasing bears around. Even in the middle of winter, he'll chase bears off when he's up there at the ski area.
That's a good point. I mean, historically, you know, you'd look at weather cues to know when the bears are, they don't technically hibernate, but when they go to sleep. And now we're getting warm periods throughout December, January, February, where you'll see bear tracks where you never used to see them. We'd go out hiking and skiing, and in February, and you'd have to bring bear spray. In April, we did the Cottonwood Trail, which is a beautiful multi-day thing. Grizzly bear tracks everywhere. So I would say, with the warming, you will see animals becoming more active than potentially they used to be.
When you go hiking, do you bring bear spray with you every time? Some of the time, do you bring a gun? Do you bring both? Do you bring neither?
In the Yukon, a lot of the places we go hiking are national and territorial parks, so guns are not allowed.
Okay.
Bear spray always.
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 Usually,
I mean,
both people, like everyone.
Everybody would have
everybody's
bear spray.
Got their own.
Yeah. Even when we walk home from the brewery, we have bear spray. There's bears all over the place.
Yeah.
It's like Alaska, I suppose. But
I'll that's a few hundred meters, something like that, to your house from the brewery.
It's
a couple kilometers.
Yeah.
Okay. But bear spray is, you know, you sleep with it next to your tent and you hike with it at all times. Yeah.
Well, Chris up the road, he carries it with him when he's at the stove making hamburgers. So.
Wow, that doesn't seem safe. Flames. No.
Then again, I mean, for a bear, I guess, what better place to eat than at Chris's grill up there at the mountain?
That's right.
I guess if a bear comes in there, he's serious.
That's awesome.
But that's good to know, and interesting to know that within the national parks, no guns are allowed.
That's right,
yeah.
So, you know, if you, as long as you're allowed and you know, keep bear spray around, knock on wood, should be fine.
We don't bring bear bangers or anything like that.
Bear
what
bells,
is a bear banger?
It's like this.
It's almost like a flare, but it's not light, it's sound. noise. So you fire it out of like a firecracker and it goes up in the air and then makes a big bang, which is meant to scare the bear. People have them here. One of the risks is that you shoot it behind the bear and it scares it towards you, for example. And they've been, a lot of the times they don't work very well. It's just to, the human voice and just not surprising a bear is, is rule number one, two, and three. And then bear spray for the last case scenario.
Well, if you're just joining us, my name is Adam Verrier. I'm the host of You're Listening to Outdoor Explorer, and I'm here with Megan and Marco Marjanovic, and we're at their brewery, Winterlong Brewery, here about 6 or 8 kilometers south of Whitehorse, and we're enjoying a beer and talking about hiking because they have a book which came out. It must have come out a long time ago.
Like 3 years ago.
Only three years ago for the book, and it's called Yukon Hiking. Or there's a line in the title of the book, A Little Guidance in a Wild Landscape. And when I am in the Yukon Territory, we've touched on it a little bit, but there's not a lot of hiking trails around here. And when I've driven through or I've been on a canoe going through the territory, I've often thought it would be a nice place to hike. It looks like it would be easy enough, but it's not like it's a lot of well-defined trails. And it seems like a little guidance, maybe some thought went into your writing of that line, and that maybe you don't need that much guidance to go hiking in the Yukon Territory.
I think it's more than that. It's we can't give a lot of guidance because of the wild nature of the landscape. You have to, we'll give you some guidance, but you have to use your own route finding skills, your own orienteering. That's right. It's just the wild landscape up here. And with the, like I said, the lack of visitors and people here, you know, we can point you in the right direction. And with the book and the website, we like to use it as a motivational tool to get out. And basically it's a psychological, we're removing a psychological barrier of just starting and figuring out where to go. Once you have that, that start, you know, figure it out. I know this is a hike. I'm going to do it. Then you do have to use, you know, our guidance, but from there, your own, you know, route finding skills and everything from that.
And maybe your own common sense because you are in the wilderness.
Well, and we noticed even in the last, so we started the website that came before the book when we moved up here 15 years ago. We've noticed if we rehike a trail from 15 years ago, we're like, wow, there's actually an actual trotting trail here now because been on the website, people have been hiking it for years.
15 years now.
So we do have some trails, but a lot of it is still just roots. And
yeah, I had read, I've been looking through your book, and earlier today I was looking at, and I don't remember the name of the trail or the hike, but it was just outside of Haines someplace. It was about a 21 kilometer hike into a glacier, and I was looking at your website, and somebody, I think that the comments started 8 or 9 years ago when the website came out. It's the Yukon Hiking website. But a recent comment said, this trail has been really, been put in and we could use an update here. This trail is now pretty buff.
Yeah.
I think other people had said that it, other times of the year, it was really difficult to get in there. See, I read through the comments and they varied wildly from this trail has totally been cleared out and it's in great shape and you could ride your mountain bike in here to somebody else saying, I couldn't get in there this weekend. It was just the weather was too crazy or there was too much snow in the middle of summer or something.
Yeah, it's so funny. In the early season, people are like wanting to go to say the White Pass or the Haines Pass for hiking. And you just like literally you have to wait till July till you can do these hikes. But people are chomping at the bit in June to do anything they can.
Is it similar in the Tombstones, which are near Dawson City? How late does the snow interrupt a lot of hikes that you might like to make later in the summer?
That's similar to probably mid-June you can do most hikes there.
Starting mid-June.
We've been there in like the May long weekend at the end of May and there's snow and you can still do a lot of hiking.
Yeah, for snow-free adventures, you need to wait till mid-June. That season, just like Alaska, the season is so short here. You know, every year I try to plan out my hikes for the year. And I start at the beginning of June, and I'm like, okay, let's do a backpack. And then, you know, April comes along, I'm like, wow, there's a lot of snow this year. And then May comes along, I'm like, wow, I mean, we need some warm weather. I'm not going to be able to do this. I can, it's like third weekend of May. We're like, okay, backup plan. We can't do that one this year. You know, we got to go do something else. So, you know, we try and be, we get so excited, ambitious, and then the reality sets in that, no, you know, in the Yukon, most years you're going to have to wait till mid-June to have that snow-free experience in the passes up high and everything. Mm-hmm. So, and then by the time September comes around, it shuts down again. So it's such a short hiking season. Very intense, but short.
Yeah.
You know, it's so nice in the summer because you've got the 24-hour, almost 24 hours of sun, depending where you are. So you can hike 1, 2, 3, 4 in the morning if you need to, mm-hmm. which is a unique experience for sure.
Yukon is a real big territory.
Yeah.
Are you guys in the practice of making long drives to go hiking, or does most of your hiking stay fairly close to town? I mean, you're trying to run a brewery also, mm-hmm. which
yeah.
I can imagine takes some time.
It does.
Yeah.
Yeah. We do drive. We don't mind driving for hiking. I mean, that's one of our passions. So, and we try to explore newer areas to us, but they always involve long hikes. Long drives. There is some hiking around White Horse, but living here for 15 years, you know, we've hiked them endlessly, multiple times. So we try, to get, you know, after the low-hanging fruit, we have to go further and further to find new hikes or explore new areas, which can be more difficult. But yeah, it's always a lot of driving. Yeah, and it is a big territory.
Yeah.
And so you have to drive.
You
get used to driving and finding them. Yeah.
You live here in White Horse. But I saw when I looked at the website, there were a lot of hikes that you had described in the Tombstones. There were a lot of hikes south of here down near Skagway, as you had just mentioned, mm-hmm. and around Haines. Mm-hmm. Are those, come to the Yukon Territory and go hiking, would you recommend they just focus on some of those areas?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I usually recommend, if you can, Tombstone number one, but it's, you know, the most farthest away from Whitehorse.
And why? What's so special about the Tombstones?
Well, you're not quite at the Arctic Circle or anything, but you're in this, like Marco described earlier, it's this alpine tundra that's like barely any trees, and the mountains are stunning. They call it like Patagonia of the North.
Mm-hmm.
That's some of the hikes you can do in there. It's a territorial park. There's the most beautiful campsite there, just right off the Dempster Highway. You can see everything around you, 360 degree views. And everything gets even more glorious in the fall with fall colors. So I always say, if you can make it to the Tombstones, definitely do. Otherwise, like anything in Kluane National Park, which is just off the Alaska Highway.
Coming from Alaska, there's the benefit of, well, for Tombstone, you can take the shortcut over the Top of the World,
mm-hmm.
which is an amazing highway. You go up there, you'll see caribou running around. It's in the, you know, you're in the Alpine. You could take the shortcut and get the Tombstone from Alaska that way.
Mm-hmm.
And Kluane, again, coming from Alaska, that's, you know, it's almost a shortcut right there as well. If you go down to Haines Pass and take a ferry over to Skagway, you've got the White Pass. So there's all of our hiking regions are centered around sort of like the 5 or 6 main highways in the Yukon. Because after you leave the highways, and there's only a few highways in the Yukon, you're now looking at fly-in hiking or paddling for a few hundred kilometers and going off from there. So you're either paddling, flying, or you've got these highway destinations. And that's Tombstone, that's around White Horse, that's
Carcross.
Yeah. And then the two passes, Haines Pass and Skagway, White Pass.
Yeah, I have to, in the interest of full disclosure, I've hiked a little bit in the Tombstones myself on a motorcycle trip up the Dempster Highway. Mm-hmm. And it was gorgeous. I agree. The interesting thing for me that I didn't realize, I've only been up there one time, but the thing that I didn't realize about the landscape is that when you get north of the Tombstones, if I understood the landscape correctly, it didn't look like it had been glaciated in the massive, glacial covering of, that went all the way down the Mississippi River, down into the United States.
Right.
You've got, it looks like steppe up there. There's plateaus that don't look like they ever had ice covering them. Do you know if the Tombstone Range was ever covered by the ice sheet, or was it maybe not?
Yeah, it must have, because there's...
And there's a lot of glacial features.
The U-shaped valleys. And,
just like you said, just north of that is where it's called Beringia, which is the area that was not glaciated during the last ice age. And so, you get those beautiful steppe-like looking plateaus, and really beautiful rocky areas that you don't get in Tombstone, but it's all around the same area. So that's the nice thing about that is you can go to Tombstone, see that sort of that young or all that different rock formations, and then go a little bit further north on the Dempster Highway, yeah. And all of a sudden, boom, a whole different landscape, yeah. The unglaciated part, which is just in such a short period of highway, just amazing differences.
Are there some small glaciers still in the Tombstones? There must be a couple, or maybe they're not. If they are, they're just little pocket glaciers.
No, we've never seen them. You know, there's the snow that might, little snow patches that would stay
year-long snow patches,
round, but it's not glaciers. Yeah.
For glaciers, that's when you're going to want to go into Kalani. You know, the largest, non-polar ice field is the Kalani St. Elias, which stretches between Alaska and the Yukon. And in between that, we have the highest, tallest mountain in Canada, which is Mount Logan. All the glaciers on the front ranges you can hike and go see. You can see the tallest mountain in Canada from some of the hikes in the front ranges as well.
And can you do that off the road?
Right off the road. Huh. Yeah, there's a few hikes right off the road.
Where off the road would you go to do that?
The best example.
Mount Ecoli,
which is
it's
just
not in the park, but it's
just north of Haines Junction.
Yeah.
Okay. And you hike in through a little river valley and then up to the top of the peak, and you can on a clear day you can see the tallest mountain in Canada.
I think a lot of our listeners are kind of familiar with the highway. I'm guessing. I know I am. Would this be, if you go north of Haines Junction, do you go all the way up the hill and over the plateau and then down to Kluane Lake and then go in that?
It's between.
Right on the top of that hill.
On the top.
There's
on the
a pull-out
high
point. Yeah. On the left.
And what's nice about
again,
being
no
at the top
signs.
Of the hill.
Yeah,
you're
right. Telling you that it's a hike.
The nice thing about the top of the hill, though, is now you're kind of in almost the subalpine when you start the hike.
Yeah.
So
and there is kind of an ATV trail. Brings you through the forest.
And then you walk along the creek. But yeah, but once you start coming down to Kluane Lake, then you get into back into the park and you get into Sheep Mountain, and that which is a stunning
That's
area.
One of my favorite hikes for sure.
Yeah. The river that came out of that area on Kluane Lake, the Slims River, a few years ago, what used to flow into the Kluane Lake now flows into the ocean.
A different way, yeah.
Because of a glacier. Was it surging at that point?
I can't remember the details now, but yeah, it's totally changed.
Changed direction completely.
Yeah.
And so the hike that we used to do, there used to be a hike called Slims East and Slims West, and it would go down the Slims River Valley and the river would come down the middle. The river no longer exists.
It's barely there.
And so you can almost do like a circle route between west and east. So there's another example of changing landscape and how it affects all the different hiking trails up here.
Because the river doesn't interrupt the it no longer becomes an unfordable spot. It's gone.
It goes a completely different direction because of a glacier.
And you're walking down a riverbed.
Yeah, exactly.
Ah,
yeah.
That sounds fascinating. That sounds really interesting. And of course, in Alaska, we have these dramatic
events.
Events and landscapes also. But I feel like it's a little bit different here. I think that I don't know if there's any place in Alaska that's quite like the Yukon territory. As far as climate and landscape, it's a little bit different in Yukon than it is in Alaska. Mm-hmm.
It's hard to pinpoint
the difference,
but you can feel it when you're in there. I don't know if it's obviously a subtle difference. Is it a subtle difference in the landscape? You know, Alaska is big and Yukon is big as well, but it's got these subtleties that just don't exist in Alaska. And it's hard to describe what that is, but you feel it when you're here. Maybe it's a lack of infrastructure on the trails, but you know, we always joke when we go on a trail in Alaska, not all the trails, of course, but even the ones around the Yukon, you might see a little boardwalk over a marsh or a bridge over a small stream, whereas you would almost never see that in the Yukon.
You're on your own.
You are wearing waterproof boots or taking them off. Yeah, you've come here. You got to be
there. You're in Yukon now, so deal with it.
That's right.
Well, you're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Adam Verrier, and our guests today are Megan and Marco Marjanovic, and we're talking about hiking in the Yukon Territory. We'll take a short break now, but we'll be back in just a moment.
This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy and sadness and anger, definitely some disgust,
Rose,
and I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer here on Alaska Public Media. I'm Adam Verrier. I'm with Marco and Megan Marjanovich, and we're talking about hiking in the Yukon Territory. I have a question for you about if we've got tourists who want to come here. You were mentioning earlier German tourists, and I've met some German tourists when I've been in the Yukon and Alaska. A lot of Germans love to come up here, and several people who I've spoken with who are German have said that they are a culture who loves the wilderness, but they don't have it in Europe, and so they come here for it. You must see that a lot in your experience.
Yeah, we do, and it's not just that they don't have the wilderness. They don't, you know, in Europe, there are a lot of people that are enjoying the wilderness. So coming to the Yukon is that breath of fresh air for them, where they get to experience the wilderness without seeing other people, and that's a huge lure. You know, we take it for granted in the Yukon. And sometimes we almost get frustrated not seeing other people on the trail or not seeing that infrastructure or having the trees grow over the trails. But for a lot of tourists, especially from Europe, see that as the advantage and revel in it and go back home telling stories about how they went on a week-long hike and didn't see another person. Mm-hmm. And again, we take it for granted, and sometimes we are, you know, we long for the opposite of that, but we do know that that is a you know, attractant of hiking in the Yukon.
Yeah, that really resonates with me. When I go to Europe, sometimes it's suggested to me that if I go to some mountain, I can go out there and I won't see that many people. And I think, that's not, I want to see the big hotel. Like, I want to see the big hotel that's built on the mountain. I want to see the tramway that goes up here. And I want to see the train that climbs the mountain, because when I'm at home, that's when I can get away. And
that's good to hear that somebody else thinks that way, because I wasn't sure if that was just us or what. But yeah, just, yeah, you know.
Well, we went to Yosemite this fall, Yosemite National Park. Yeah. And we were like, this is insane. There's so many people here. The parking, you know, getting to the trailhead and just finding a parking spot.
I did a two hour hike, and I counted the number of people on that 2 hour hike that I passed, and it was 650 people.
Yeah.
I hadn't seen that in a lifetime.
Did you need to get your abacus going?
I was getting very, I used to be a software engineer. I'm not technologically incompetent, but yeah, I have never seen, you know, we might see a few people on the trail in the Yukon.
Some
advantages.
Popular ones, you might see quite a few, but that's always great too. Mm. Yeah,
it is good. Sometimes safety in numbers. You know, I did a hike with a friend a few years ago, the Slims River East in Kalani National Park. It was early season. It was Plan B because there was too much snow. We were hiking the trail in, and I have never seen so many bear tracks in my life. I'm talking hundreds, maybe 1,000 bear tracks in the 6 hours of hiking. And we get to our camp and we're kind of like, we should go away and cook somewhere not near our tent. It's a bit nerve-wracking to see that many. We're obviously on a bear highway. And then a few hours later, while we're eating dinner, six ladies show up with two dogs, and they're camping right next to us. And most people would probably get frustrated if they maybe were looking for, you know, that solitude. We couldn't have been happier. Now all of a sudden, and we have two dogs, and they were just right off the side of us, and we could sleep easy that night. We didn't have to feel like we were the target for those, 100 bears that must have been walking around that area. So
yeah, as they say, you maybe were sizing these people up and saying, "That's right. Oh, we can beat them
we can outrun them. They're going to sleep in." And actually, that the next day when we were all hiking towards the glacier view, we didn't see them, and we're like, "That's odd. Like, we should see six people and two dogs." We got back to camp, and what happened was they were a little bit behind us. And between us and them was a grizzly bear, and they had to detour completely off to the track so we couldn't see them. And so they had the safety numbers. We were there, you know, as a backup. And so it was nice to have
and
other
I
people.
Literally did that same trip the next year with some friends, and we had the same situation. Tons of bear tracks. It was just three of us. And then when we got to camp that evening, another three people show up, and we're like, perfect.
Great.
And we saw a grizzly bear at the glacier view, so with cubs, and we're like, okay, perfect.
Yeah.
Let's get out of here.
I was thinking a little bit about multi-day trips, and clearly you do some of them. Are there any classic multi-day trips in the Yukon Territory that we also were mentioning tourists coming in from outside? I would think that you've got tourists who want to do a multi-day wilderness type of thing in the Yukon.
You know, it's interesting. The tourists that come to do multi-day trips often know about or hear about some of the trails that we don't typically aren't as popular in from the Yukon perspective, like the Donjek Trail or
right.
the Cottonwood.
They usually have a guide.
Often they'll have a guide. One of my the classic from the Yukon perspective multi-day trips is in the Yukon or sorry the Tombstone Range, mm-hmm. Grizzly, Talus, Divide Lakes.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only hike multi-day hike in the Yukon where you have to register for a campsite on a very specific day
like
and a very
January
specific time, and mm-hmm. it sells out. It's the only place in the Yukon where you have to do that. And yes, it's going to be busy. Yes, you're going to see other people, but it is fantastic. It is top notch. It is so beautiful. And that is a very popular overnight hike.
And that's a one overnight. You could hike in, stay at the designated camping.
There's three designated campsites.
So there's three lakes and you can camp at each one. So you can make it like 3 to 5 days if you wanted.
And it's just fantastic. And then there's the the other ones that are popular, like we mentioned, the Donjek or the Cottonwood from mm-hmm. outside of the Yukon. Megan did the Cottonwood a few years ago, and just
that was a 4-day hike. Beautiful, yeah, like a loop. So we left the vehicle at one end, and
that's right off the Alaska Highway there, where the Donjek.
So that's that's the Donjek. The Cottonwood is towards Haines, Alaska. Oh. So it's on the Haines Highway, but it's in Kewaunee Park still.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And I did the Donjek Trail, which is they recommend 8 to 10 days. I did it in 7 days, but we saw four groups on the trip, and they're all tourists from actually some from Alaska, and the rest were from Europe, and they were all guided. Except for one group, there was two guys from France who came to do this. They wanted just to have a backcountry experience. And, you know, just live off the land sort of thing. And it was interesting. So we ran into them on day two of the 7 days. They had 11 days to do this. And we chatted with them and we said, how is it going? They said, well, it's going okay, but we're eating just cold, dehydrated meals. And I said, well, was your stove not working? How come? They said, no, we'd heard in Canada that you just make fires to cook all your meals. And I said, nope, that's not. We have modern technology. We use a backpacking stove. And they said, well, we wanted to use a fire to cook all our meals. That's what we thought you did in Canada and in the Yukon. And so we didn't bring a stove. I said, okay, well, but surely you've made some fires and couldn't cook. They said, oh, we also thought Yukoners didn't use lighters. So we brought a flint. And I was like, are you kidding me? Like, we're not, you know, caveman here. We use lighters. And so again, that day they hadn't had coffee or a warm meal for 3 days at that point. So the next
day, and they're only 3 days into 11
3 days
days,
into right? 11 days. Yeah.
It's horrible.
So the next day, before my buddy and my hiking partner and I left them because they were taking a bit of time, I gifted them a pink lighter, and they were so grateful.
That brings up an interesting. You talked earlier about hiking guides. So there are hiking guides in the Yukon Territory. Mm-hmm. I get the impression because you had mentioned that you've met people on guided trips. Is that a pretty common thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's quite a few different companies.
Yeah, guiding is one of the tourism guiding is one of the part of the economy in the Yukon. We have a lot of tourists that come over looking for guides.
Right? Yeah. Like there's a lot of hunting guides, but there's also a lot of, you know, canoe trip guides or hiking. You have the multi-day stuff.
The canoe trip, the main canoe trip, I would imagine, being the Yukon, or do you have a lot of
people looking at Mackenzie? Big. There's a lot of those bigger ones, in, like the Peel River and the Snake and the Wind. Those are all up north.
Is the Peel River, that flows north into the Arctic Ocean?
Yeah, it goes into the Mackenzie eventually.
Into the Mackenzie. And do you have a lot of people staging those trips out of Whitehorse? Like they get on a plane here and fly into those?
Or you drive 5 hours and you fly out of Mayo. It's a community in central Yukon. But
they all arrive in Whitehorse as the first step.
Or you can fly out of Dawson City, I suppose. But
Well, this this encounter with these French guys who came out planning to kill bison for their kill mammoth, woolly mammoths for their meals sounds kind of interesting. Have you come across a lot of other people in the? I mean, obviously, you've said you don't come across that many people when you're out hiking, but have you met some people that really that their techniques really surprised you? People that maybe needed a little guidance, or just people who are kind of eccentric and.
We learn most of it through the comments on our website, and it's gold. Mm-hmm. I mean, you definitely find, you know, we have to put a rating for our each trail, and it'd be easy, medium, difficult, and you'll get people come over with a range of experience, and you'll see them, complain horribly on the website, said, it said it was easy, and
it's just up the whole way.
Yeah, I know. They're totally unprepared. Why did they wear flip-flops? I don't know. But we do see a lot of people coming to the Yukon not prepared for what they're going to get, especially if they're self-guided. And so, having the comments on the website really helps to kind of get a window into what people are experiencing, because we come from the Yukon and we just have a different outlook on how it is. And sometimes it's nice to be reminded that not everyone's used to just bushwhacking for 6 hours. Mm. So we have to tone it down and
or at least have those disclaimers on there.
That's right. So you do see comments, I guess, from people that I think your rating system is something like 1 through 5 for difficulty. Mm-hmm. And a hike that you might rate a 2 or something, your basic hilly hike, and you get people saying, This was crazy. No infrastructure.
Absolutely.
I took my life in my hands when I went out.
Yes, okay. Lots. And I'll tell you what, in the last 15 years, we've toned it down. Maybe we've gotten older, or maybe we're not as fit as we used to be, but our ratings have come down from
change a few.
Yeah. We take
from
all
easy
the feedback.
To moderate.
Yeah, we take all the feedback into consideration for sure.
Well, speaking of people that are maybe only marginally prepared or even well prepared and get into trouble, because it can happen to the most prepared of us, is there anything unique about people getting into emergency situations here as opposed to maybe a little bit more populated areas? I mean, clearly it's going to be different than a place like California or Colorado when you're pretty close to to civilization. But what can people do? Do people typically take spot devices?
Yeah, like we have an InReach, and we've had the Spot Messenger things as well.
Do you use those yourselves?
Yeah.
You do?
Yeah.
Is that typical for people, do you think, to use those devices here?
Probably on I don't know, it depends. Like, say if I'm doing a hike without Marco, I just like him to know where we are on the route and that kind of thing. And just in an emergency is great, but say if we were going on a day hike, we might not bring it.
Or it'd be like a honey, I miss you sort of thing, and you know, we'd be texting, or how's the weather look like tomorrow?
Yeah.
But yeah, there's people that get stranded on one side of a river and stuff like that. The water comes up really high, and we've heard of people, say on the Donjek, having to get flown out because of that. So
there was no
got to have something. For a multi-day, you want to have some kind of safety communication, I would say.
Well, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the book and the website. I have been looking at your website all morning in preparation for our conversation today. And like I said, this whole conversation started because I got a look at the book and I thought, this is really interesting. For one thing, the photos that are in there are beautiful. I guess you've taken them all yourselves.
We have, yeah.
Yeah. It just inspired me. I found the book really inspirational. And as you say in the book, it's a little guidance in a wild landscape. And I think a big part of the allure of the book for me was simply inspiration. I looked at some of those photos and some of the hikes, and I thought, you know, next summer I need to take the motorcycle over there and go on a combination motorcycle hiking trip, mm-hmm. which is the way I still feel. I mean, I'm here now, but I think maybe 6 or 8 months, 10 months from now, it'd be nice to come back and do a little hiking. Can you tell me a little bit about how the website and the book is set up? I mean, it's pretty straightforward.
Yeah, the website came around when we first moved here. So even going back further, we were hiking in Australia and New Zealand, and it was totally set up for hiking, and the information you could get from books was just unreal. And we got to
In Australia
and New Zealand. And then we get to the Yukon, and
there's a couple guidebooks.
There were a few guidebooks, nothing online. And it just seemed like, and we were ready to hike. We moved to the Yukon, we're ready to hike. And boom, where do we go? Yeah. And so
this is the same thing I wonder when I come over here.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Looks great, but I don't know where
to go. I don't know where to go. Yeah. So, like I said, I was a software engineer. We had moved here. I didn't have a job. We were kind of experimenting, making this website, but our passion was hiking. So we got a few trails up there, and we're getting comments immediately saying, wow, where were you guys all, you know, my whole life? And then we kept adding and adding and adding. We were getting very obsessive, and the website is very geared towards the information part to it. So it's mm-hmm. geared towards, you know, recent comments, perfect directions and everything like that.
Directions, maps, photos, you know, you can click on a little Google Earth thing and look around. On the website.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So the website is like,
you can download the GPS and the waypoints.
Absolutely. So it's all the data is on the website. But what we thought was lacking was that real inspiration coffee table. You're sitting down in the middle of winter. What should I do? And that's where the idea of the book came along. It was less fully informative. We don't have a lot of maps in it, even trail routes. That's where we say go to the website. But what it is, as you just mentioned, it's supposed to be inspiration and motivational. Yeah. So you're supposed to flip through this, get motivated, get inspired, and then look at the website, find out all the directions, and get out there. So very different in terms of the book versus the website. I know that listeners can't see the book, but it's huge. It weighs as much as a full 1 liter water bottle. It's a lot.
It's something to be left on the coffee table.
That's right.
Your vehicle.
Right.
In fact, we're planning the second edition, and it's going to be 20% heavier than this one. So
to make sure that people leave it.
To make sure that you leave it on the coffee table.
Yeah, it's set up. The book has 8 regions, and then we have 80 hiking routes included. So basically, you can go to, say I'm going to Carcross, and you can look on that Carcross page, and you'll see all the hikes in that area, the distances and stuff. So we have the kind of table summary information, and then you can see, oh, I want to do an 8-hour hike.
One thing I noticed on the website was that you have the hikes gridded in a table, mm-hmm. and one of the columns in the table is distance from Whitehorse.
Yeah, that's right.
And so I suppose when most of the people in the territory live in Whitehorse, that's pretty helpful.
That and tourists, yeah. So we
we
wanted to have that metric. That's not a metric you'd find in most hiking sites probably, but that metric is because a lot of people are based out of Whitehorse, and so they now have that information. I'm here for a few days, or I'm here for a few, you know, a week. Where can I go with my ride, with my my rental car, with my guided company from Whitehorse? Mm. Yeah. And the book itself was, if you look at it, it's very photo-centric. It's not black and white either.
Each hike has full-color photos.
And it's all for inspiration.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
all for motivation.
Which is completely different than, for example, I don't know if you're familiar, I grew up in northern New Hampshire in the Appalachian Mountains, and there's an Appalachian Mountain Club guide, which is the complete opposite. It's meant to be taken in your backpack. It's tiny, and it is not at all inspirational. It's only informational.
Yeah.
If you're doing this hike, you start here, you do this, and this is where the amenities are, and this is how you do it.
Yeah.
And it's as simple as that. No extra information. And this book is kind of the opposite of that.
It is the opposite. And it took years to think of the layout and how we want to present this book, because you want to have every detail in there, but if you did that, this book would be an enormous encyclopedia. You'd have to, have like volumes of it.
The other thing it's lacking is really the maps and more photos.
And data points and whatnot. So, but we just wanted to focus on people getting inspired and getting out there. That's the first step. I think if you can inspire and motivate somebody, to go to Tombstone or Kluane or anywhere around Whitehorse. That's the first step. And then from there, they'll dive down into the details.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, if you're just joining us, I'm Adam Verrier. I'm your host here on Outdoor Explorer. And today I'm in Whitehorse speaking with Megan and Marko Marjanovic about hiking in the Yukon Territory. You said you were inspired to start the website and the book quite a bit later because I don't think you had any other... Were there no other resources? And are there any other hiking resources as far as information in the Yukon Territory? Or is this kind of it?
There was, and there still are.
Maybe three or four other books. There's a couple for Tombstone. There's one for Kluane. And then there's one that's more a Yukon-wide one.
Some of them are now
out of print. Yeah.
Oh. So we have outdated copies. And they were our jumping off points. And we have to, you know, acknowledge them for what we have found. And then we went above and beyond and found a lot of our own hikes. And
from driving down the highway and being like, ooh, that looks cool. Can okay. we get up there?
Yeah. So these weren't necessarily publicly, I mean, it's not like you found, you just, hey, we went hiking up here and it worked out pretty well, so we'll put it in the book kind of thing.
That's like most of them.
And sometimes it takes like multiple times of hiking that route because you might not find the best thing the first time or make a mistake. So it might take us years to actually put that hike on the website.
Okay.
Until we feel confident that we have it decent.
It's a labor of love because definitely, you know, you do a hike and you're like, oh, I want to go over here and take a look over there, but I have this GPS track and I don't want to deviate it so the follow, you know, people on the website can see it. So I won't go look at that. I'm just going to go straight up. You go look at that.
Yeah.
And so it's you have to be, you know, when we go for a hike, it's not just going for a fun hike. We're always thinking, what photo should we take? How should we collect the track? What's the best way for someone to go up or down? And there's a lot of thought that goes into every time we do a hike.
Sometimes, yeah. You feel like, oh gosh, where are we leading people? But yeah, it's always been worked out.
Yeah. Do you tend to go, when you go hiking yourselves, do they tend to be kind of big trips? Like even if you're just driving down the road a ways to go for a hike to an interesting spot, or is there a regular hike you do for exercise? Just like a couple days
certain
a week?
Times
just
of year,
blast
even.
Out here.
Yeah, there certain is, times of year, like, yep. On Mother's Day, we do a hike just down here with our son. And yeah, now we're doing a lot of the hikes with our 7-year-old. So yeah.
We're seeing hikes in a different light with a kid. You know, what can the kid do? What can families do? It's a new dynamic for sure than our
past days.
Before,
it used to be just let it like, oh, that peak looks awesome. Let's do that. Now we're like, oh, let's do some easier hikes too along the river or...
Yeah.
Try to get a good range of things where before it was very focused on what we were only wanting to do.
But we don't always drive. Like on a couple of days ago, I just wanted to get out. It was a nice day and I went and hiked a very classic route, which is half an hour drive, which is nothing for us. Fish Lake, you go up, get a beautiful view up to the Alpine and come back down. And so there are lots of hikes that we do seasonally, like Megan said, or just because they're close, we want exercise to get out.
Megan, what's your favorite hike around here that you...
I mean, I think I already mentioned I really love Sheep Mountain area. I think it's so unique.
And Sheep Mountain is beside Kluane Lake.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so you get up, you don't just get the perspective of Kluane Lake, which is just gorgeous. It's that like very bright blue glacial looking lake. But you get these like beautiful peaks. You get that Slims River Valley, which is gorgeous. You can see glaciers, colorful mountains. There's like a Red Castle Ridge, it's called. It's like this beautiful red ridge. Mm. It's just the colors are stunning on that hike, and that's one of my top ones I always recommend.
And do you have a favorite that is different than
that? I have a new favorite, and let me preface it by saying that we now have a new piece of gear in our repertoire that changes our hikes. It's an electric mountain bike.
Oh.
It has now changed our access considerably. You know, we were able to do day hikes that would normally be quite long because of the access in a really short amount of time. And so one of the hikes that I've now fallen in love with because of the electric mountain bike, and I can shave off many hours, is Mount Lorne, just south of town. It's about half an hour from here. There's a long approach to get to
through
the forest to get to the ridge of the mountain. On an electric mountain bike, it's actually incredibly fun. You get up, you get to the circular route, you stash your bike in the forest, Then you hike this amazing narrow ridge that's safe but still has a little bit of exposure on it. Get back in your bike and you're back down to your vehicle in no time. So we've been using electric bikes a lot now, and it's really opened up some of the hikes that we've done. Even our car drops, you know, when there's a hike that's separated by maybe 15, 20 miles, so I stash an electric mountain bike, do a hike, grab it, and come back to the vehicle. So it's opened up a new terrain for us that was not there a few years ago.
That's really fascinating to me, because I have some opinions about electric bikes. I'm a person who thinks that electric bikes are great for commuting, and it's much better than driving a car, that's for sure.
Right.
But I maybe have some other opinions about electric mountain bikes when used just for exercise. I wonder maybe sometimes how much exercise somebody's getting. Mm. But you're commuting to hiking.
That's right.
On an electric mountain bike, which I've never thought of.
That's right.
And that makes a lot of sense. I can think of a lot of hikes near where I live in Alaska. Yeah. An electric mountain bike would make it, so I would go out and I would do it. And even on a regular human-powered mountain bike, it might be a long trip. But with an e-mountain bike.
That's right.
I've never thought of this. This is a new idea for me.
We've reached mountains even just behind the brewery here, behind Mount Sema. There's a mountain we've wanted to climb for years called Mount Granger. And it's about 40 kilometers round trip with a mile high of elevation gain. And we were really able to do that in 6 hours with our e-mountain bike, because we could cut off the entire distance on an old mining road. Exercise-wise, it's still a lot of exercise.
Yeah, right. But it's opening up a hike that you wouldn't do because it's just too much of a hassle.
It would become back roads and stuff, and you wouldn't want to drive your vehicle on it.
It would become a multi-day trip versus a six-hour
Or you just wouldn't do it.
If you're like me, you'd say,
maybe some other year.
Yeah.
But I can't spend 3 days on this. I got the afternoon, or I got one day.
Yeah.
With an e-bike, you can get in and get it done.
It's opened up a lot of our hikes now.
That's really interesting. Yeah. In the same way, I mean, that's the same way that snow machines are used for backcountry skiing.
Right.
But maybe people who wouldn't own a snow machine if it wasn't for the access into the backcountry skiing.
Yeah.
But you can get to places that you couldn't get otherwise, and so the snow machine only ends up being a tool to get to the place where you want to get to. And if you didn't have it, you just wouldn't go there.
Just wouldn't go there.
Yeah.
We just got a snow machine this year, by the way. One of the problems we're finding is, like, you know, we're doing these hikes with these e-bikes. How does that translate to a route that could go in the book or on the website? Because if you don't have an e-bike, would you do, say, Mount Granger, which is 40 kilometers? Yeah. So we had to create a new section on the website last year called
Beta Blog.
It's a blog style versus an actual trail hiking description. And it just gives people beta in case they would like to get into these areas, into these mountains, and they have either the time and want to do multi-day, or they have an e-bike. So we are now getting into a section that we don't know how to translate into hiking guide territory, because you need specialized tools like a mountain e-bike. So it's just new territory for us, and we've just discovered the last few years, and we're not sure how that's going to translate to the website or the book going forward for guiding.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, this has been a really fascinating conversation, especially the last part of it, because I've got some new ideas about maybe a shopping trip that maybe I should make. but I think I just noticed that we've run out of beer, so I think that's the signal that we've probably just about run out of time. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me, taking the time off from brewing beer here at Winterlong Brewing, and for hosting me here at your brewery and talking about hiking.
Absolutely. Hope it inspires you to come back to the Yukon and go for a hike.
Yeah, I think it already has. Yeah. So a big thank you to our producer, Eric Bork. And from all of us hosts here at Outdoor Explorer, I'm Adam Verrier, and I'll see you outdoors.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.